We read 2 Samuel 15 2 weeks ago, and it's a relatively long chapter. I don't desire to read it all over again. I was only able to cover about half of the chapter at the time as far as what's in it. As a prophet study course, it's my job to do as best I can to disclose what prophecies there are inside of each chapter. That I can see, of course, that God's been willing to show. I have here packets I typed up. These packets contain... this packet... One's enough? Okay. I contain... Oh, there's a packet. There are four sides of it, two sheets of paper. The first two pages consist of a chiastic structure of 2 Samuel 15 through 20. And the third page is not terribly important, it's just various similarities. And the fourth page, the last page, was what I talked about 2 weeks ago. Well, I had a lot of problems 2 weeks ago. There were a number of people who got completely lost, is what I was talking about. No big surprise there. It happens, almost once every few times. I got thinking about this. Why is it that I'm losing people? This is not the first time it's happened. And I realized that it's because, I was talking to my wife last night, that when God gives you a tool and you don't use the tool correctly, it doesn't work. And I used it incorrectly a few times and still wasn't working. So, well, it's probably best I use the tool in the way that God told me to use it. I'm hoping that'll work better. Is that up now? You still getting there? All right. This structure, we'll get to what's written up here in a minute. He's going to get it up on the board, the screen there in a few minutes when his computer recovers. This structure, first of all, I realize some of you don't know what a chiastic structure necessarily may be. Does everybody know what a chiastic structure is? No. Okay. I'll describe this briefly to you. It shouldn't take too long. A chiastic structure is a Greek word. Chiastic is chiasmus. It is a poem form. It's something that is written in a pattern or a sequence of events designed to draw your attention to repetitions. We do it in songs all the time. You have the chorus of a song comes over and over again. That's the chorus is the objective of the whole song. It may sing, four or five, six times. The objective is you always remember the chorus, and all the other various lyrics point you back to the chorus. Well, God writes that way too. It's in Hebrew, of course, not English, but still the principle is the same. So what God says, you got it up ready? Oh. Hold on a minute. No. This one. Yep. What God does is says, all right, I'm going to repeat something to you. So I want to give you a story. Let's say a story is a paragraph long, or 5-6 verses. So verse number 1 will say something like, give me an example. Yeah, roses are red. Roses, I can't spell roses, forgive me, red. If I could spell, I wouldn't be in the profession I'm in. And then that says verse 1, right? And then verse 2 says, violets are blue. I don't spell violets, so forgive me, V-I-O-L, and blue. And then the third verse will say black. Just say the word black. The fourth verse will talk about violets and them being dark blue. Dark blue. And then the fifth verse will say something like, roses are pink. The objective of writing this way, which your Bible is smattered with this every few chapters and verses, is that it's designed to draw your attention to repetition. See, verse 1 I've written up here and verse 5 both talk about the color of rose. Okay. Verse 2 and verse 4 both talk about the color of violet. And then verse 3, right in the middle, talks about no color of any flower, just the color black. The objective of writing this way is to draw your attention to the color black. It's the one thing that's different from the pattern. It points your attention to, look at the pattern, here's the similarities, oh, here's something that's out of the pattern, and returns similarities. God does it all the time. It's the center, or the chiasmus, the center point, or changing point, of a structure. Structures are so common throughout the Bible. You will notice when you've read something, over to you, for example, today, we read Numbers chapter 7. How many times did Numbers chapter 7 repeat itself?
12.
12 times, right? What were the differences from each section? They were completely identical except the names of the men. So the objective of writing in that fashion is to draw your attention to the names of the men. All right? Now, God repeated them over and over and over and over again. It's telling you, since every structure was completely identical, or the format was completely identical in every way, what does it tell you about the names of the men? That as far as God's concerned, these men and their tribes are identical in value and worth to one another. There's no one greater or worse, or not as profound or less profound than each other. Well, I did a quick structured analysis of what was read in chapter 7, because it was funny. Not that it's too terribly important, but there was something else also written in Numbers 7. Since we've covered it, it should take a few brief seconds to cover this again. I'm a terrible estimator of time, as my mother already knows, but it's okay. See, what number 7 did is, instead of this little form, which I point out, it goes to 1, 2, 3, and then started to go back 4, and then back to 5, it didn't go back 4 and 5. It just did like 1, 2, 3, and then 1, 2, 3, and then that type of pattern over and over and over again. And the difference of those 1, 2, 3 was number 1, or number 3, because that was the names that changed. Well, you can do another type of structure that tells you something a little bit different that God has used many times past as well. In this structure format, notice I have the word roses as number 1, and roses number 5, and pink and red. As I mentioned before, designed to catch things that are out of sequence. Well, it also tells you equivalency. That, yes, we know roses are the same, but as far as the author of this little structure, me, red and pink are equivalently the same. There's no significant difference between red and pink. Red is pink is red. They're both technically, if you look at it, they're very similar, not quite identical, but they're along the same family. And I'm also telling you that blue and dark blue, with the violets of being blue and violets being dark blue, I'm telling you they're equivalent and the same. But blue and dark blue is basically the same thing. Black, of course, I'm using is different. Well, this is the same thing in Numbers chapter 7. Not that I'm going to get through great detail of this, but just a brief moment. For each one of these little minor groups were started out by the man's name and his family line, and of course it was ended with the man's name and his family line. So, point number 1, the man's name and his family, and point number 5 is right up here, or the end of it, is his name and his family. Well, if you match the pattern and start trying to make a structure that looks like this that I have drawn up here, out of these 1, 2, 3s, 1, 2, 3s, 1, 2, 3, over and over again, you notice certain patterns, certain similarities, the equivalencies show up. Just for example, in verse, we'll say the very first person was Judah, from the tribe of Judah. So, verse of chapter 7, Numbers 12 and 17, 12 starts with the man's name, 17 ends with his name. Well, you go one step earlier, meaning right after this man's name, it refers to an offering of one silver platter and its value, or the weight, and one silver bowl and its value, or its weight. Well, just shy of, in earlier in verse 17, before he lists his name, it points out you have the oxen, 5 rams, male goats, and the 5 lambs, and their value is their first year. The weight, the value, is the first year versus the silver platter and its silver bowl. The weight and value was the value, the unit of it. Because that's just how we value things. We value things in their weight or monetary value. one God. He values things in measures of, in units of years as well. They still, the unit of measure is a unit of measure. So you go through the process, you can say, oh, well, the God's saying, in that first example that I just rattled off to you, that the silver shekel and the bowl and the weight of the platter is as far as how we would value those things. We are to also equally value the animals which we eat the same fashion. They're equivalent in value or importance to God. We go through a process, you narrow down, because after it rattles off the bowls, it points out what's in them, which is the oil and the grain offering. Well, you go further up on the bottom of the list, in verse 16, it points to the next thing before the peace offering sacrifice was the goat and the sin offering. So the oil and the grain is equivalent to a sin offering. I mean, as far as God's concerned, the oil and grain, or mincha offering and sin offering, are spiritually equal to one another. Now, these verses do not have a turning point. They just continue to match one another. And then, of course, they narrow in on the gold pan of 10 shekels is equivalent, spiritually speaking, to the bull, the ram, and the male lamb in their first year. The first year, 10 shekels is equivalent value, or unit of measure, as a burnt offering. So the gold pan with the incense is the same as the olach offerings, as far as spiritual value to them. Granted, this is a very unusual way of looking at it, but it's very common. This is not a great example, but we just read it, so figured I'd just use it again and point it out to you. Yes, Ellie, you had a question?
Okay, there has to be something what you're saying, because what he could have said is each of the tribes brought blah, 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 and just written down the names of the guys that brought them.
It would have been simple to do that.
Yeah, he didn't have to take up two pages.
Yeah, 90 verses of, to say
to
something
go through
that
the same thing in the same way over and over and over. So he had to have a reason
for doing
that.
There's a reason to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it to draw our attention to repetitions. Well, this is just a quick example, completely outside of what I was going to talk about today, but it's the principle of a chiastic structure. To repeat itself, to draw your attention to variances or deviations. So, in the paper before you, as I mentioned before, the tools and the way which I was taught to use them, I will now use them in the fashion I was taught. Actually, I'll use my little pointy thing up here. The very first page, you'll notice there's a sentence. Actually, a couple of sentences. They're actually sentence fragments. And it starts out with the letter A. Right? So it's A. It says in 2 Samuel 15, verse 10 to 12, I have it written, this is condensed, of course. Absalom rebels against the king, referring to David, of course. And it says, this is one of the quotes, when you hear the sound of shofar, this is one of the phrases that Absalom states in these two or three verses. And Absalom, of course, steals the hearts of the men of Israel, and, quote, there's no other king, one before the king to understand you. Now, I have this label with A in 2 Samuel 15, verse 10 to 12. If you, so okay, to turn your page over, actually open it up, I should say, and the bottom of the second page has an A prime. Will you please scroll down to page 4 on yours, all the way down to the very bottom? Keep going down, keep going down, keep going. Thank you, stop. It says, not too far. Go back up a little bit. Return. Yeah, right, that's good. It says, Sheba rebelled against the king. He sounds the shofar. Of course, this is 2 Samuel 20, verse 1 and 2. And the men of Israel follow Sheba, saying, we have no part in David. It's one of the quotes to make. Note that there's a lot of similarities between A and A prime. Did anybody notice that? They kind of say similar things. A different person is saying it. Oh, would you like another copy? I have extra copies. In case you're interested in plenty of copies of. What it's telling you, this is just like as I pointed out here, on my little diagram, number 1 and number 5, the rose is red, rose is pink. We have two individuals in the text of chapter 15 through 20 is saying Sheba and Absalom are doing similar things to one another. As far as their lives, what's happening around them. Stay right here for a moment. Now, my little A prime, you go right up there, I have indented in a little bit, B prime. Well, B prime, this is the same as, I didn't go back to the first page yet. It's Samuel 19, this is verse 40 through 43. So the men of Israel and Judah argue over who's more loyal to the king, referring to David, of course. And David and his servants, of course, end up passing over the Jordan. This is known as the triumphal return. Please go back to page 1 now. Scroll up to the very top, Richard, please. Page 1, this label B, not B with a little asterisk prime mark. It's a verse 2 Samuel 15, verse 13 to 24. The king's servants say the words, "Whatever my lord the king decides, your servants are ready," which is a declaration of loyalty. And Ittai, a particular servant of David, in these few verses, says, "In whatever place my lord the king will be, whether for life or death, there your servant will be." This is also another declaration of loyalty, which is, many of his servants say this in these few verses, not this exact phrase, but declare the declaration of loyalty. And David, of course, and his servants pass through the Kidron Valley, which is the same as the brook of the Jordan River, or the Jordan, the same location. So you kind of notice that B, my little mark here, B, and B prime are somewhat similar. Not identical word to word, but they have similar themes happening, similar events kind of happening in reverse order. The same thing, of course, scroll down a little bit further to point number C. We'll scroll a little further, Richard, so I can, thank you. This point C, it says that this is on the page 1. 2 Samuel, this is 15 from 32 through 37. Hushai, one of King's David's close advisors, comes, he meets the king, and the king says, "You will be a burden to me." Tells him, "Do not come with me. You instead defeat Ahithophel's council," who's a person who defected to Absalom. "Defeat his council for me and stay behind." Now, turn the page over and go over to C prime on the second page. Please go, thank you. Stop there, sir. Barzillai came to meet the king. And Barzillai says, instead of the king saying, "You're a burden to me," like he did to Hushai, Barzillai says to the king, "I will be a burden to you." And Barzillai says he has no discernment, meaning this choice which what is good and what is bad. Note, Hushai's purpose was to discuss and defeat the discernment or the counsel of Ahithophel. They both refer to a discernment or pattern here, similarities. And of course he says, "Please let me stay back." That's kind of similar to what David said to Hushai, "Please, you're a burden to me, you are a counselor, stay back." And Barzil says, "I'm a burden to you, I have no good counsel, I will stay back." They're similar, not identical, but similar. You notice right above my C prime points out D prime, which is 2 Samuel 19, 24 through 30. Mephibosheth, which is a descendant, one of the sons of Saul, who's long since been dead. Mephibosheth came, he meets the king, and the king asks Mephibosheth a particular question, and Mephibosheth and Ziba, one of Mephibosheth's servants, have to end up dividing Saul's property by the answer to this question. Please scroll up to D, the very top of the page. Well, that's good enough. D, on the your front page, it points out that this is 2 Samuel 16, verses 1 through 4. Ziba, who is, of course, referred to on my little D prime point, comes to meet the king instead of Mephibosheth. The king asks Ziba a question about Mephibosheth. And then the king gives Mephibosheth's whole property to Ziba. You know, both D and D prime say similar types of things, don't they? You can go through this page yourself. I'm going to go through everything. It's excessively silly. But E, E prime, F, F prime, they all narrow down. They keep saying similar types of things as each other as they narrow down. Which, as I mentioned with my little example here, is God's objective at the way he wrote the section or had the section inspired, however you should word it, to draw our attention to these similarities and their turning point. Please scroll to point L, if you'd be so kind, sir. That's good enough. Down a little further, sorry. That's stop. So stop, yes. Thank you. I didn't bold print it. Sorry.
I'll look for the bold.
Yeah, sorry about that. L. This is the center point of the turning of the story, which means at this point is where everything starts mirroring one another. It's the chiasmus or the central axis. It says, this is in 2 Samuel 17 through 27, sorry, verse 27 through 29. Three men brought David and his servants all sorts of provisions because they were hungry, exhausted, and thirsty in the desert. Now, of course, you'll read this, and you're saying, well, and don't get me wrong, we'll be getting to these chapters of 2 Samuel eventually. We're just going through this, the order in which I learned it versus piecing it together like a puzzle, which is just a different way of doing it. You'd read this, say, okay, what's the point? Why would God, or if you wish to argue, the author of 2 Samuel 15 through 20, Exeter God doing it, why would he want us to notice this section? Ellie, you have a comment. Go ahead.
One thing is that it has the number 3 in it.
It does have number 3, you're right.
Which is messianic.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Tammy.
It seems to me that most of these chiastic structures, whether it's in 2 Samuel or anywhere else, they're placed there to reveal clues about the Messiah, either events in his life or about his role as Messiah. Well, what is this Messiah supposed to do? So it's either his role or something that's going to happen in his life that is going to be, aha, that's something the Messiah is going to do or something that's going to happen to the Messiah. So when we see that happen to a particular person, we should take notice of it and maybe pay attention to that person to see if they are the Messiah.
Very well said. That is the primary objective. As I mentioned in previous times, being up here, that the central thing that everybody in the early prophets look at is not what we today are looking for. You and I today, we look for the return of Messiah. Well, they're looking for his first arrival still. So they're going to write about his first arrival. The things that God reveals to them that says, hey, somebody's going to do certain things. And they're not going to know the details. They won't know his name necessarily. They won't know, they might know, his birthright or all the details about him exactly. But they know that there are certain events that are supposed to happen. And if you run across somebody that matches enough of these events, pay very close attention to that individual. That's the goal. And Messiah points out almost the entire, this is in Mark, I think it is, of the prophets are all directed and talked about me. That's the biggest thing. Well, so if we read the prophets, what do we expect to find? Him. We expect to see that. So there's no difference here. Now, I didn't explain my entire structure here, which I will, just haven't gotten there yet. I'm not going to do it today, of course. But I'm going to go through it partially, because right now we're going to focus a little bit closer on Samuel 15. Those first, the first 3 points, A, B, and C. Go back to page 1, if you don't. Would you please scroll up to the earlier top of the page there? Thank you. Yeah, that's sufficient. That's good enough. So our structure, which was our little central point, and point L, as it points out, which is a 17, its start occurs in 15 verses 10 through 12. That's the beginning point of where we're entering in a structure. Is this structure terribly important? It's very important for what the author is trying to convey and tell us to teach us about. So this particular verse, let's go to Samuel 15 verses 10 through 12. Let's read that. 2 Samuel chapter 15 verses 10. Absalom then spies throughout the tribes of Israel, sent to spies throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, when you hear the sound of the shofar, announce, Absalom has become king in Hebron. With Absalom went 200 men from Jerusalem, who were invited, and went along innocently. They did not know anything of Absalom's intention. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gileonite, David's advisor from his city, from Gilo, when he slaughtered the sacrifices. The conspiracy was powerful, and the people with Absalom continually increased. So, he's referring to a shofar blast. When you hear this, go ahead, throughout the whole countryside, declare that I am king. I wanted to bring your attention to point A, because point A is where our structure begins. We're going to identify who Absalom is as far as God is concerned. I don't mean like who he is biologically. I mean, who is he in the Messiah's life? Because Absalom is a major character from 2 Samuel 15 all the way through chapter 20. He's a big focal point. He's the instigator of a rebellion. He, of course, gets killed in the process. There's a big deal about him. So if the structure is telling us about Messiah, we would expect to say the text the structure is in is going to tell us about the Messiah. So let's learn a little bit about Absalom. I have written up here on my little colored board here, I have three columns. There's Absalom, Adonijah, and Hasatan, or Satan. Absalom and Adonijah are both brothers. I don't recall whose mother Adonijah is from. I forgot, but they're both David's sons. There are certain basic similarities that we see here. Very, very basic. But hopefully they'll point enough to it. Is that God has chosen, we haven't obviously read Adonijah's story just yet, but we will get there in a few chapters from now. But Absalom's story, who we're starting out with. As you've noticed, I put a previous pattern up here about David and Bathsheba. I put up Adam and Eve and Amnon and Tamar, and did this similar type of pattern, this little grid pattern, the similarities between each of the stories, how it was written. Well, these individuals have similarities. Absalom, Adonijah, and Hasatan, their first primary similarity is their looks. How attractive they all are. Now let's look at that real quick. Let's go to 2 Samuel 14, verse 25 and 26. Let's see, back to 14. This discusses Absalom's great appearance. I'm pointing it out for a reason. Chapter 14, verse 25. Now there was no one in all of Israel as praiseworthy for his beauty as Absalom. Bottom of his foot, the top of his head, there was no blemish in him. When he would have his head barbered, at the end of every year he would have his hair barbered, because it became heavy upon him that he had to barber it. The hair of his head weighed 200 shekels by the king's weight. Fair enough. We can go ahead and stop those two verses. Now, of course, we read this back when we were discussing chapter 14 a number of weeks ago. And so, yes, okay, somebody's very attractive. Now, does the Bible go out and describe people's appearance very often? So why do you think God would feel it important enough to disclose how beautiful this man looks in chapter 14? Is it just because he just felt like it? Oh, let's talk about somebody's beauty. God's usually not too superficial very often. Yes, Tammy.
Because it was the focus of Absalom.
It was. It was Absalom's individual or personal focus was his appearance. And that's the key. If God went out of his way to discuss Absalom's look, then by the way, how many people did he discuss their great appearance for? Saul was discussed on height. David was discussed as ruddy looking. Yeah, a little reddish hair, a little maybe possibly curly. But Absalom, Adonijah, which let's read Adonijah, this is 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 17, discusses a little bit about his looks. Of course, he's a son of David. Maybe they're all obsessed with their appearance. chapter 2, verse 17, this is Absalom's slightly younger brother. Did I get the right? 1 Kings 2:17. Did I get the right chapter here? Oh, crud. No, I think I wrote the wrong chapter down. Dang it. I hate when I do that. Let's try it earlier. That's back when he gets executed. I don't thought execution. That's silly. Oh, crud. Hold on a minute. I apologize for this. Should have been more careful of my screw my little notes here. Let's see here. That was written down. Because unfortunately, I just wrote down the date, or the point which he gets asks for a wife, I should say. He was asked for a wife there. Well, while I find this again, I apologize for messing this one up. Let's look at Hasatan's for a second. Hasatan's a more easy to point out. If you look at Ezekiel 28, this, of course, is another description of somebody's great beauty or appearance. So Ezekiel 28, we can find Ezekiel 28. Ezekiel 20, this is discussing Hasatan's great appearance. This is verse 12. Son man, take up your lamentation for the king of Tyre. Now, granted, king of Tyre, king of Babylon, these are individuals actually exist, but inside their prophecies, they actually talk about or refer to somebody who is very beyond mortal, which would imply that is the principality over the king of Tyre, or Tyre himself, or the principality over Babylon. This is the Lord. You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Yeah, a lot like Absalom. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Now, obviously we know that King of Tyre wasn't physically there because he wasn't around yet, but there was another individual there. Every precious stone was your covering, the sardis, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, sapphire, turquoise, emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you, and you were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created. Now, we already know, obviously, the king of Tyre wasn't physically there in the Garden of Eden. He wasn't a covering over the Ark of the Covenant at all, in any way, shape, or form. But yet, this individual is being described that way. In the objective or the purpose, the description, is the only individual who matches this, because it continues on at the end of 15 and 16, would be Lucifer himself, is who's actually being described here. Now, it focuses very greatly upon Absalom's beauty, Satan's beauty. I gotta find that other reference, because I don't know how his beauty was also listed here. All three of them are being similar in appearance. And what's the point of making something perfect in appearance? Pride. What else?
God. So just because a person is, you know, physically attractive does not mean that they're a good person to follow. I mean, and not only that, but it, you know, the New Testament brings out that Yeshua was not, you know, great looking in appearance, that he was just average.
You're absolutely right. There was an appearance. A few weeks ago we talked about the appearance. Think about Yeshua. Yes, Timmy.
The verse you were looking for about Adonijah.
Yeah.
Is 1 Kings chapter 1, and it's part of verse 6. Basically, you might call it 6 part B, where it says, and he was also a very handsome man, and he was born after Absalom.
God bless you, Tammy. I appreciate that. So 1 Kings 1, 6. Yeah, yeah, it's helpful to have a computer on staff, doesn't it? I apologize. So, pretend it didn't happen. So, Absalom, Adonijah, and Hasatan are praised for their appearance. Now, is it the only similarity between all three of them? Well, no, it's not the only similarity between all three of them. There's another similarity I have written down here, is exalting oneself. In 2 Samuel 15, verses 1, which we're covering 15, but in verse 1, for Absalom, it points out that Absalom, of course, prepared for himself a chariot, horses, 50 men run before him. Now, that strikes as somebody who was creating a throne for themselves. And I continue to jump down to verse 10, which Absalom spit sighs about all the land, saying, when you hear the sound of shofar, announce Absalom has become king in Hebron. So Absalom in 15 is making himself by physically putting people, as well as the 200 men who went with him to go for this sacrifice, making people beneath him to subservient themselves to him and become or declare himself king. Well, in 1 Kings 1 through 52, verse 52, I should have marked these books a little faster than this. Adonijah does the exact same thing. He doesn't prepare a whole lot of people in front of him, but a few. First Kings 1 through 2, verse 15? No. I got the wrong book written down. What happened here? Verse 5. Yeah, I don't know. I must have screwed something up. 1 Kings, not 1:52. It's 1 Kings, verse 5. Drop the number 2. Man, I'm doing really terrible today. 1 Kings 5. Chapter 1, verse 5. Now Adonijah, son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared himself chariots and horsemen, 50 to run before him. Sounds very familiar to Absalom, right? Well, in Isaiah 14, Hasatan's accused of the exact same thing. I'm doing this for a reason, so I can point this out to you. Verse 13. Ah, okay. So I wrote this one down right. So Isaiah 14, starting in verse 13, referring to Lucifer, of course. Well, we'll start in verse 12. How you have fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations. 4, verse 13, you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mountain of the congregation, on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. So all three men are exalting oneself. Now, I'm not going to go through these. I'm sure I probably wrote that one down wrong, too. So let's go. And that probably is right. I think I actually did write down 1 Kings 2:17 correctly there. The last similarity is whoring people after himself. We already know in 2 Samuel for Absalom, we recall, which we haven't read it yet, but we've read it in the past many times, that the 10 concubines that David leaves behind tend to the house. Well, Absalom, of course, goes to the top of the house and has his way with each of them in the sight of everybody around. The objective, of course, it makes all of them whore after him. Of course, by his own command, which is not too different than what you know Satan does too, for the people of Israel, people of all faiths, to go after him, to whore after him, by his own will and command. Well, Adonijah actually, in, I'm going to read there, 1 Kings 2:17, asks for a wife who is none of his business to ever touch or have for any reason ever, ever, ever. And Solomon says, excuse me, he knows better. He's asking somebody to whore herself after him. Inexcusable, this particular woman is not allowed to be touched. And he knows it, but he asks anyway. So all three men have their looks in common, exalting oneself in common, over God, and making others whore after them in common. Certain similarities of character. I'm pointing this out to you. Because my point up here of A, it points out there is no one before the king to understand you. I mean, Absalom was making that declaration to the people of Israel when he was trying to convince them he should be a good king. There's no one for the king to understand you, that no one before God, or God is not on your side. God does not understand you. God's not with you. Be with me. I'm right. I'm the better way. Rebels against the king, exalting himself up of, over the king. Does not Hasadon exalt himself up over the king? That is the objective. That this similarity I have written up here, the purpose is to point out that Absalom is acting like Satan. And it's important that he does that. Because Absalom is a messianic figure, but the dark side of it is the we already discussed this previously, that Messiah, he obviously was the Son of God and everything, but the act of death, of him actually dying, he was not acting as the Son of God at that moment in time. He was symbolically being sin, symbolically being Satan at that moment in time. The process from his arrest all the way through the beating process and the accusations and the torture, everything that's going on, sin was being tortured up until its moment of death. I'm not saying he was Satan. He's not. Saying he was playing that character. It's no different than we've discussed, actually, Jeff points out 2 weeks ago, that we have David's Talmud has two goats, right? You put your hands on the one goat, you slit its throat, and its blood goes on the other goat, and you push up. It's the taking away of sin from the congregation, and putting it outside the camp, away from us. Well, we know the Messiah is a type of atonement for us. Well, that was the whole symbolism. The goats are Messiah. Well, if the goats were laying our sin upon them, then they are being like a sinful item or sinful object, and you wish to kill or get rid of it. Well, Messiah was doing the same thing. Well, in the case, in this instance, Absalom and Hasatan are going to be that portion of Messiah's life, that symbolic culmination of all sin. Let's continue on. Hopefully I haven't lost anybody yet. I think this is very interesting to me. In verse 14, well, let's just read part B here. As I point out, it says in part B, this is from verse 13 to 24, the king's servant said, where my lord decides, your servants who are ready will follow you. It's high, a particular individual says, in whatever my place with the Lord the king will be, whether life or death, their servant will be too. And David and his servants, of course, pass through the Kidron Valley soon to be following. Does that sound familiar at all to anyone? Sounds familiar to Peter, doesn't it? Declaration of loyalty to the Messiah, which is where we're going to head. But first of all, one more detail about this little section is verse 14. It says, David then says to his servants, this is by you, after David hears about the conspiracy and that Absalom is now, of course, the declared new king, and so the heart of a man of Israel has gone out to return to Absalom. David says to his servants who are with him in Jerusalem, arise, let us flee, for there will be no escape for us before Absalom. Hurry to leave, lest he hurry and catch up to us and thrust evil upon us and smite the city with the blade of the sword. So David, having just heard that Absalom is in taking over, tells all of his supporters, get out. These are things that are going to happen if we don't. These things are going to happen to you. This is the trial you're going to go through. I'm going to stop there for a second. Let's go to the New Testament real quick. All these things in my little structure I've written up here are what the Messiah goes through too. Messiah and David are living the same life during this section. Through this entire, all through chapter 20, Messiah and David are matching each other's steps, foot for foot. And God planned it that way. Because the objective, of course, of all this stuff, prophecies, is to declare itself about the coming Messiah, not the return of him. So, we'll start out in Matthew 26, verse 20. Now the evening had come, and he sat down with the 12. As they were eating, he said, surely I say to you, one of you will betray me. Someone betrayed David, and someone's going to betray Messiah. And they will be exceedingly, they were exceedingly sorrowful. And each of them said, Lord, is it I? They said, he who dipped his hand with me in the dish will betray me. Let's see, how far I go. Will betray me. The Son of Man goes as is written of him. But woe to that man whom the Son of Man has betrayed. It will have been good for that man who had not been born. Then Judas, who was betraying him, answered, Rabbi, is it I? And said to him, you have said it. So he's declaring that someone's going to betray him. In Mark, verse 17, says a similar thing. And the evening came to 12. Now as they sat, Jesus said to the city, one of you with me will betray me. And they began to be sorrowful and said, is it I? They answered, it is him. It is the one of 12 who dips with me in the dish. The Son of Man indeed goes as is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for him that he had not been born. And then Luke 22, verse 21 through 23. Behold, the hand of my betrayer is with me on the table. And truly the Son of Man goes, as has been determined, woe to that man whom he has betrayed. Then he began to question among themselves which one of them who would do this thing. So he's starting out initially that there's evil intentions amongst someone who's going to betray him, which is similar to what was going on here with Absalom. That he's a betrayer. So we know there's a betrayer for the Messiah, just as Absalom's betraying David. But all of his servants say, is it me? They're questioning their own loyalty. Is it I? Is it I the one who's supposed to betray you? No. It's not all of you. It's just the one who betrays with me, or does this, dips with me. But more happens here. In verse... it also, in John, this is actually the fun part. Well, to me, it's fun. To each of us their own. Okay. In verse 21, chapter 13, verse 21 of John. And Jesus had said these things. He was troubled in spirit and testified them. Most surely I say to you, one of you will betray me. Then the disciples looked at one another and perplexed about whom he spoke. Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of the disciples whom Jesus loved. Simon Peter therefore motioned to him to ask who it was of him who he spoke. Then leaning back on Jesus' breast, he said to him, Lord, who is it? And is he, and Jesus answered, it is he to whom I shall give a piece of bread when I have dipped it. Having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. Now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him. Jesus said to him, what you do quickly. But no one at the table knew for what reason he had said this to him. For some thought because Judas had the money box that Jesus had said to him, buy those things we need for the feast, or that he should give something to the poor. Having received the piece of bread, he went out immediately, and it was night. So Jesus is saying, John is saying in chapter 13, that the person who is betraying Messiah is Satan. He's actually pointing that out. The Jews scary. They're actually that is the betrayer. So question: who's Absalom? The betrayer. So if these are in fact similar, which it gets much more evident further along you go through these chapters, he's saying that the betrayer in John is Satan-inspired Judas, right? Well, that would imply that Absalom, who is a betrayer of David, is a Satan-inspired Absalom. That's what it would imply. And the further along we go, and the past we already know of Absalom, he was, I wouldn't say Satan-inspired necessarily, but Satan-directed, in some of the things he already has done up to this point. But notice what David also says here. First of all, actually, we're not quite finished here just yet. It says, whatever my Lord decides, your servants are ready. Let's do that first. That is matched out with, let's see here. Let's go back to Luke 22. I'm just going to one spot. It takes too long to go through all these various verses. Back to Luke 22 and verse 24. Now there was rivalry among them. Now there was rivalry among the men of David too, they were all declaring, oh, I'm loyal, I'm loyal, I'm loyal. Believe me or trust me, I'll be with you. There's rivalry among them, which we consider the greatest or closest in the kingdom of God. And he said to them, the kings, the Gentiles, exercise lordship over them. Those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors, but not so amongst you. On the contrary, he who is greatest amongst you, let him be as the younger, he who governs, you know, as he who serves. For he who is greater, who is greater than he who sits at the table, or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves, but you are those who have continued with me in my trials. And I bestow upon you a kingdom, just as my Father bestowed one upon me, that you may eat and drink at my table my kingdom, and sit at the throne judging the 12 of the tribes. Now in verse 31, so you have the same, yeah. Verse 31, continuing on. The Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed, Satan has asked for you, that he may be swift to sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you, that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. And he said to him, Lord, I am ready to go with you, both to prison and to death. And he said, I will tell you, Peter, you shall walk over this day before you deny me three times. Yeah, notice that. It sounds very familiar with Ittai's statement to the king. Whatever my place the Lord will be, whether life or death, your servant will be. Why is Ittai saying that to David? Now, we read this a couple weeks ago, I realized that. But Ittai, if you recall who he was, he's a Gathite, he's a Philistine. He left Gath to come to David's protection from the king of Gath the day before. Right before this happened with Absalom. So with 600 of his men and all their families, just arrived in Jerusalem and declared to David, we're with you. We have no provisions other than what we actually, our physical bodies carry. This is what we've got. Please protect us. I will serve you. And David says to him, when he finds out from Absalom, says, wait a minute. You just arrived yesterday. Your families are here. We have no provisions with us while we're fleeing. Stay behind. Give your families rest. Absalom has no knowledge of you as far as whether you're a lawyer. He has nothing to fear. But Ittai says, no. Whatever place my Lord will be, whether life or death, your servant will be. He, all 600 men, and all their families with no provisions came with David. That's loyalty. That's loyalty that strikes almost what Peter had said to Messiah. Whether life or death, I'm going to be with you. Yes, Ellie.
I never before put it together that Satan was out to have Peter be the one that betrayed him.
Yeah, that
never
was the objective.
Never saw that before.
That was the objective.
Judas was the one he could get. Yeah, Richard told me that last week. That...
Yeah.
Never saw that before.
Yeah, this Absalom's character is very, very, very close to David. Just like Peter was very, very close to Messiah. They were very similar in many respects to one another, how they treated other individuals, how they trusted in God throughout the early parts of their lives. They were almost identical. They stood up for what was right in spite of whatever happened up to this point. So in similarities and closeness, Absalom and Peter are almost identical up to this point. So Messiah and Peter, you could argue the same thing, are very similar and close, best of friends. Or didn't Peter Messiah asked Peter, "Do you love me?" Yes. You keep asking over and over, "Do you love me?" You then take care of my sheep. Do what I can't do when I'm gone, and don't betray me in the process. So Peter was the first choice of Satan. Oh, that's a perfect choice to betray him. And of course, no. So it said that Messiah prayed, God granted Messiah's request. Peter was not the chosen choice. Judas was instead. So we have a sequence of betrayers being selected by Satan or influenced by Satan to betray Messiah, betray God, and betray David. Now, right after, and this is also in John, this has been pointed out here that says, wherever your servants will go, David, your life will be too. David and his men then passed the Kidron Valley. This is also this all point B of my 2 Samuel section. Well, note that when Jesus had spoken these same words, they were just finishing dinner. They now fleeing or leaving Jerusalem. They head where? Well, to the Mount of Olives. But to get there, what do they do? Well, John chapter 18, verse 1. As Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples. Note, David goes out with all of his servants. Over the brook Kidron. Hey, look, the Kidron Valley. They pass over it. Where there's a garden, which, this is verse 1 still of John chapter 18. There's a garden with which he and his disciples entered. So David and his men, after declaration of loyalty occurs, they're all ready to leave. They all continue to go through. They all pass the Kidron Valley, just like the Messiah did. Pass the same Kidron Valley. To where? Well, in 15... I should pay attention to the clock more often, huh? In chapter 15 of Samuel, he continues on with what's actually happening. He starts matching Messiah's foot for foot. Let's see here. Verse 30... Okay. Jump to 2 Samuel 15, verse 30. David was going up on the ascent of the Mount of Olives, crying as he ascended, with his head wrapped, going barefoot, and all the people with him wrapped their heads and went up, crying as they ascended. Someone told David, "Please, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom." And David said, "Please confound the advice of Absalom, O Lord." As David was approaching the summit where he would accustomed to prostrate himself to God, and there he saw him, of course, with Hushai the Archite, with him and his tunic torn, dirt upon his head. Note a similarity there? Probably not, but I had to read it again myself. Let's see, where is it? It's a verse, I think it's back in Luke. Let's see. Luke. 20, okay, verse 39. There it is. Okay. So Luke 22, verse 39. So it points out that David, of course, goes barefoot, head uncovered. We'll discuss that some other time. Past the Kidron Valley already, he's walking his way up the Mount of Olives. Well, after the Messiah leaves this whole shebang with all of his disciples, and they've been dug in, they're talking, and Judas Iscariot's gone, he, of course, goes over to the Mount of Olives, the same path he passed the Kidron Valley, just like David did. He goes over the Mount of Olives. As it points to verse 39, and he was coming out, he went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed, and his disciples also followed him. When he came to the place, he said to them, "Pray that you not enter into the temptation." As he was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw away, he knelt down and prayed. Why is it that both men were doing the same accustomed thing? Well, I look at that. These are similarities, not mere images, but similarities. David has a custom. As he's going up the Mount of Olives, just as Messiah is going up the Mount of Olives, he doesn't go all the way to the top, of course. David continues on, because David's fleeing. But as they're going up, they both have a particular, peculiar custom. They stop at a certain point along the mountain and pray to God. Bless you. Where's God? Well, okay, see. Mount of Olives is here. The temple should be behind them. Roughly behind him, not quite exactly, but off to the side. So when Messiah is going up to this Gethsemane, he prays to God. Where is he facing? Probably toward the temple. Now, if it's David's accustomed, it says David is accustomed to pray to God. He would prostrate himself to God. Well, where is David pointing? If he's going up the same mountain. The temple doesn't exist yet. To place the temple. Why is David pointing the place of the temple? Well, David designed the temple. He knows exactly what it's going to look like. He knows where it's going to be built. There's all details about it. And the tent of the ark is probably already there. Yes, Ali.
We talked about the bareheadedness before, but we didn't talk about the barefootedness. He's barefooted and he's bareheaded.
He's covered, barefoot.
Okay, he's vulnerable.
Yes.
He's covered by God, but he's vulnerable.
This is a different... this particular topic regarding covered head and barefoot should be postponed to another day. That is a large-scale subject matter. Because you have to go through Jeremiah, you have to go through Isaiah, not all of it, of course, Jeremiah 14, Isaiah 20, to discuss the details of a head and a foot and what that actually means, along with earlier, 2 Samuel, I think it's 13 or whatever it is, when Tamar has her head covered in dirt. And there's a lot of similarities and more details beyond the scope of today's discussion. So, we might cover that some other time. So, I know I'm way over time. I apologize for all of you to that. But, so far, does it kind of make sense? A little bit, that there's certain parallels going along through here. The parallels don't stop there. They continue through the entire book of 2 Samuel 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19, and the first part of 20. That the sequence of events that happens to Messiah is the same sequence of events that occurs with David. The people's names change. The actual words in the storyline itself changes. But as I pointed out here, the thematic similarities are there. As we've discussed many times in the past, I'll conclude with this, that when you're discussing prophets and what they prophesy in the future, all the prophets of the Old Testament, all they get to see is a shadow or an image of what it's going to look like. They don't actually get to see the Messiah himself. So they're not going to describe the Messiah. They're going to describe details about him that God's feeding to them, but not the complete picture. They don't get the complete picture until he shows up. But if they're prophesying, they're going to prophesy details about it so we can recognize when we see enough shadows of the same object, we can slowly piece together what the object should look like. And then when the object shows up, oh, hey, look, it fits. He's the right one. The early prophets did that a lot. The later prophets don't do it quite as much, but they still do it to some extent. But the later prophets focus more upon not the first coming, but a little bit more on the second coming, of the images of what to look for of the bad guys and the good guys. They won't tell you all the details necessarily, but they'll give you enough shadow to say, okay, hey, when someone shows up, oh, hey, look, he fits. That's the piece of the puzzle. I'll have to stop early. I apologize. Well, early. I'm late, but earlier than what I was talking about today. So, I hope I didn't lose anybody. But I'm trying to follow the sequence of events how I was taught it. So it's a little bit easier to use tools the way they're taught, not the way I was trying to do it in previous weeks, which is, here's a piece of a puzzle, let's start putting it together. Now you know what the puzzle is going to start looking like as we piece it together. Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat.